like the reference to anti-immigration motivation on the part of some of these groups, a clear reference to the El Paso mass shooting in 2019. The issues that got us here have been brewing for really years now, and this is entirely predictable, which I think really shines a spotlight on why now, why January, why right after the Capitol attack, and really more relevantly, where was this a year ago?
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 1st, 2021. On January 27th, the Department of Homeland Security issued an unusual National Terrorism Advisory System bulletin. Unusual because it addressed solely the heightened threat environment of violence from domestic violent extremists, with no mention of foreign terrorist organizations or even the word terrorism. It's a striking document, both for what it describes and for what it leaves unsaid. I sat down in the virtual jungle studio with the A-team of folks to hit all sides of this. First, Carrie Cordero, former counsel to the National Security Division at the Department of Justice and senior associate general counsel at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Andy McCabe, the former deputy director of the FBI. Elizabeth Newman, former deputy chief of staff to the Secretary of Homeland Security and assistant secretary for threat prevention and security policy there. She ran the unit that wrote this bulletin. And Nick Rasmussen, former director of the National Counterterrorism Center. We talked about this bulletin, its context, and what comes next. It's the Lawfare Podcast, February 1st. DHS warning, domestic violent extremists. Let's start off with a description of this National Terrorism Advisory System bulletin that was put out on January 27th. Carrie, could you hit the highlights of this just to set the stage and make sure we're all on the same page, literally, in terms of what is being described here?
Sure, David, and nice to join you. So this was a National Terrorism Advisory System bulletin, as you mentioned, issued just recently on January 27th, 2021. Notably, it was issued by the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, who has been in his position only since January 20th on Inauguration Day. David Pekoski is the individual who was the TSA administrator, someone who had been previously Senate confirmed, and he's a former commandant of the Coast Guard, and he currently is the individual designated by President Biden to serve as acting secretary until the nominee, Ali Mayorkas, is confirmed. And I expect we'll come back to the fact that he has not been confirmed as of our conversation here. But the advisory council is a bulletin, which that type of advisory describes current developments or general trends regarding threats of terrorism. And it describes the fact that DHS believes that the heightened threat environment across the United States will, quote, persist in the weeks following the successful presidential inauguration, unquote. And so then the bulletin goes on to describe how domestic violent extremists, which is the language that DHS uses, in this particular circumstance, the subject of this bulletin, are motivated by a range of issues. And the three issues that the bulletin highlights include anger over COVID-19 restrictions. The second is 2020 election results. And the third is police use of force. So I think it's important for us to focus in our conversation on the fact that this is not a bulletin that only covers a certain type of domestic violent extremists. It does aim to cover a very broad range of domestic violent extremist sentiment in the country. And the bulletin then goes on to describe the fact that DHS is concerned that these particular drivers to violence are going to be persistent. In other words, these are not particular threats that DHS thinks are going to disappear in the days after the inauguration or even the weeks or months. This particular bulletin will be active until the end of April. And so one of the things that will be interesting to see is how the department follows up to this particular bulletin. So I'll pause there and hand it back to you, David.
Yeah, thanks, Carrie. It is interesting, right, that they list these three issues, and it's an including statement, so it's not exhaustive, but yes, anger over COVID-19 restrictions, okay. The 2020 election results in the middle, which kind of seems like the big one in the wake of January 6th. And then the police use of force, saying that DHS is concerned about these drivers to violence and the fact that some domestic violent extremists may be emboldened by the January 6th breach of the U.S. Capitol. Easy to see that in the case of the election results, not so much in terms of police use of force, a bit of a disconnect there. But let me turn to each of you to see what strikes you when you see this bulletin and its different take than previous bulletins. Elizabeth Newman, let's turn to you first. What strikes you about this?
Well, you know, it's my former team that wrote this bulletin. So I'm seeing, you know, particular personalities and some of the new language. If you go down to the bottom, there's like, how can you help, and the be prepared section. And, you know, these bulletins are designed to be one page only. So like when we were producing the bulletin that came out a year ago, you know, I recall us, you know, doing this group edit thing where there just isn't enough space in one page to put everything in that you want. So I think some of what you're picking up on and the disconnect usually comes from, there's not enough space to put everything in there.
You're right. It is the densest government document that I've seen, probably since that famous spaghetti PowerPoint chart that DOD put out about issues in Afghanistan some 15, 20 years ago.
Exactly. And of course, the language, I think they even have like a little disclaimer down at the bottom, like, hey, all of these terms are defined in, you know, DHS's lexicon, which if you click on it, it was hard to find, or it doesn't exist what the lexicon is for DVEs, because that's a relatively new term that got developed in the last couple of years. So for the layman, I heard some criticism that this was hard for a member of the public to understand what it means, because it has so much of these words that when I read it totally makes sense and I get what they're saying, but I can completely understand that maybe we need to do some work on how we communicate to the public more clearly about what the threat actually is. And then the last thing I want to point out, and I'll go back to what I was starting to say, that the how you can help section, those bottom two bullets are new language that I don't think DHS has ever used before in a public way. And this is coming from our new prevention team. We have an Office of Targeted Violence and Terrorism Prevention that built off of efforts that Nick and his team participated in the Obama administration to create a countering violent extremism effort. It evolved and it's matured. And now we have a fairly well-funded team of people that are working on prevention concepts. So these bullets, your choice can make a difference. Choose nonviolent ways to make your voice heard and support friends and family in doing the same. Communities are strongest when they're not divided. Strengthen your community by standing together against violence. That's their influence coming into what you would normally see in a bulletin like this, tended to be more about the protection actions that you could take. And you still see that in the be prepared section, avoiding large crowds and be responsible for your personal safety. But I'm seeing some maturity in the bulletin. I think I'm sure we'll get into it. There are things left unsaid. There might have been a reason for that. But just the fact that they got it out within a week of the Biden administration starting, that's a good step forward, in my personal opinion. This probably could have been issued as early as last summer, definitely should have been issued by November, December. So they're a little late, but glad they were able to get it out.
We will definitely circle back to that. Nick Rasmussen, what's your first take of this?
Thanks, David. Well, first of all, yes, one of the denser pieces of one-page government publication that you're ever likely to see. But if you follow the hyperlink that takes you back to the broader Homeland Threat Assessment document that DHS put out back in October, all of these themes were developed in much greater detail at that time. It, of course, didn't forecast that our Capitol would be breached on January 6th, but it certainly talked about election-related violence potentially being a problem or concern. It certainly talked about the inauguration being a potential flashpoint, though it certainly did not forecast January 6th. So clearly, DHS professionals in the intelligence part of DHS have long thought, as Elizabeth said, that these were issues worth highlighting to state and local community partners around the country. And they just obviously use the opportunity of the change in administrations to put this out in a form where it will get wide dissemination and wide consumption. The other thing I wanted to hone in on quickly was something that Carrie pointed to, and that is that the sunset provision that speaks to this product being reviewed on April 30th. And I guess I'd be interested in Andy's view, Carrie's view, Elizabeth's view, your view, David, but I suspect it'll be very difficult to sunset this document anytime soon. And anytime we went into any kind of alerting document, that was always something we had to have in mind, was to think about what conditions would have to prevail for us to step back from the assessment that we're offering here.
Right.
And it's just hard to imagine we're going to be in that space anytime soon. There will be tweaks to this in months ahead when they review it in April, but I suspect this is a kind of a steady state assessment that DHS will be continuing to share with state and local partners for some years to come.
Andy McCabe, pick up on that point, both on the fact that this is being issued at the end of January, but is set to expire on or before April 30th, and then anything else about the document that really jumps out to you.
Sure. So I would certainly echo Nick's comments about the sunset provision. I think this has been necessary for such a long time. I think the threat issues that it raises are so pervasive right now. It is almost impossible for me to think of a series of conditions that might cause DHS and its partners to walk back from this sort of warning on April 30th. And I think that raises the whole issue of timing. I think like the rest of you, you really scratch your head as to why it's taken so long to come out with a warning like this, especially with some of the specific things that are pointed out in the bulletin, like the reference to anti-immigration motivation on the part of some of these groups, a clear reference to the El Paso mass shooting in 2019. The issues that got us here have been brewing for really years now, and this is entirely predictable, which I think really shines a spotlight on the question of why now, why January, why right after the Capitol attack, and really more relevantly, where was this a year ago?
Carrie, let me circle back to you to ask for your impressions, but also to take it one step bigger. Not in the document itself, but in the accompanying introduction on the DHS website, it emphasizes that this is put out after consultation with intelligence community and law enforcement partners. That is, of course, typical, but highlighting that hits an issue you have written and spoken widely about the need for better consultation across the national security and law enforcement enterprise on these overlapping issues. So in that context, what are your reactions to the bulletin?
So a few things. First off, I do think the bulletin is at a pretty high level of generality. In other words, what it does is it finally acknowledges and puts some names to this, some of the specific domestic violent extremist streams that we're observing in the country, but it's not particularly actionable. So to the extent that part of the role that DHS serves is to serve as this bridge between the intelligence community and the federal government and state and local partners, this particular bulletin, I'm not sure how actionable it really is at the state and local level. It identifies themes that are pretty apparent from the public discourse. And so it's important that they do that. But I do think it's worth noting that it's very, very general, and it's not particularly specific in a way that I think can be operationalized. One thing it does do is it does convey the sense that these will be persistent threats. And I would expect that the issues that are identified in the bulletin, the types of domestic violent extremists that are identified in the bulletin, are threats and challenges that are going to remain with the national security and homeland security community throughout the Biden administration. And so one question that I have is, in particular, thinking back to my old organization in the National Security Division of the Justice Department, what changes are we going to see within the Justice Department to better coordinate and potentially involve in a more substantial way the National Security Division in responding to this domestic terrorism stream of threats along the same lines that it has been heavily engaged in foreign national security threats going forward.
Let me follow up with you, Carrie. You mentioned the National Security Division at DOJ. And to a lot of people, this bulletin, maybe because it is at that high level of generality, it doesn't appear that it's going to be necessarily useful to people who are working issues in places like the division. So tell me, you know, at NSD, is this a useful document in any way? Does it clarify anything? Does it prompt any new action, or is this truly outward facing?
My sense of this is that this is outward facing. I don't necessarily think that this document is telling people who are working on national security and homeland security issues something that they didn't know before. I think what it's importantly doing is it's acknowledging from a public perspective, and it's communicating to the broader national law enforcement community that these are potential motivators for violence domestically. So I tend to think that the public value of it and the dissemination in a public way throughout the country is probably the more significant role versus its value to the existing national security and homeland security community.
Sure. Elizabeth, let's turn back to the bulletin itself and the art form, the format of the National Terrorism Advisory System Bulletin. This is the first one we've had in more than a year. I believe the last one was right after the turn of the year from 2019 to 2020, following the airstrike in Iraq that killed Qasem Soleimani. And before that, it had been some 6 months. And that one was only a reissue of the one that had been out at least 6 or 7 times, the General Foreign Terrorist Organizations Exploiting the Internet to Inspire, Enable, and Direct Individuals Within the Homeland. So these bulletins are not common. Talk to us a little bit from your perspective, having run the division that does these. How does a bulletin come about? Is there some groundswell among the officers working the issues to suggest one come out? Is it always top down? Talk about the balance between those and how it is one of these emerges.
Well, I think it's interesting as you and Carrie were talking about the usefulness of it. Those debates are often happening internally. Like, we're not telling people anything they don't know. Do we really, what's the point of issuing these things? Part of the answer is because Congress told us to, and it's kind of the classic duty to warn. If we have information of a threat, the government bears the burden of informing their citizenry, right? So some of it's just, it's a box checking exercise, but I would argue that In an age where there are so many voices out there and so many assessments, you know, the moment that Soleimani was killed, you had any number of national security experts going on TV, assessing what happened, criticizing what happened, applauding what happened, and, you know, speculating on how they might retaliate, right? So in that particular instance, I think it's fairly well known, DHS was not a part of the conversation leading up to the decision to strike him. So there was definitely a bit of surprise. And there was a what we call a senior leadership group phone call that night, a couple of hours after the news broke, to just kind of pulse check everybody. And it was not mentioned at the phone call, but immediately thereafter, there were like 3 or 4 of us that started exchanging notes and then eventually emailed the acting secretary and deputy secretary and suggested that we needed to consider issuing a bulletin. We'd give the analysts like the morning to kind of assess things, find more information out, and then determine whether a bulletin was necessary. And it, since nobody had done it since 2015, and of course, most of the leadership was not there back then, it took us 2 days, and in my opinion, took too long for something that potentially could have been rather urgent. So the purpose in an instance like that, when you have a very quick change, is to try to get everybody on the same page that the community's assessment is that there's a potential for retaliation, and therefore, yes, law enforcement, those talking heads that you saw on TV might be correct, and yes, you might want to strengthen, you know, reevaluate your footprint, strengthen, you know, your protection around certain areas. some of it's just a validation exercise, and some of it is in a world when we have so many voices out there providing various forms of analysis, trying to provide a unified voice to what we, the U.S. government, are seeing so that our partners can take actions. But as Carrie noted, there are other ways in which we communicate with our partners. So this is not intended to be an operational document or a tactical document. Usually what follows when you issue these, there are phone calls with Homeland Security advisors, with law enforcement partners, with critical infrastructure partners, with cybersecurity partners, depending on the nature of the threat. Like DHS operates any number of, you know, thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands of people participate in our various partnerships. And so all of those networks start to pay attention, and then they are evaluating it from their vantage point. You know, I'm a power company, or I'm an energy company, and this bulletin is saying that there's a history of threat to critical infrastructure. Okay, what do we need to be doing? And they'll talk amongst themselves, and DHS will be a part of that conversation, and FBI will be a part of that conversation. But this just kind of gives you the level set, and then we go deeper. And it's in the maybe non-public, not obvious to the public conversations where we get into the operational and the tactical.
That is very helpful to hear the DHS outreach, if you will, to state homeland security centers and others. Of course, Nick, there's a parallel process to that, and hopefully one that works arm in arm with that, which is the work at the National Counterterrorism Center, which you used to run. And there's, of course, explicit mention in this bulletin of DHS encouraging the SLTs, the state, local, and tribal, and now territorial, something that I had not seen many years ago when the SLTs were listed, but reaching out to state, local, tribal, and territorial homeland security partners. These are relationships that NCTC has as well in terms of getting information at the appropriate classification level to those partners to warn of threats, to give context to the kinds of things they're seeing on the ground, and honestly, to also inform analysts at NCTC. Now, traditionally, that happened much more with foreign terrorist threats, and it wasn't as much NCTC working on the ground with state, local, tribal officials analyzing the threats within their own communities that aren't necessarily inspired or directed from overseas. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that dynamic, how NCTC was before you got there, how it evolved during your time, and what you're seeing now in terms of how NCTC can play on these issues.
Yeah, that's a great set of questions, David, because again, I almost find it embarrassing to say this out loud, but during the entire duration of my tenure as director at NCTC, I can't recall a single conversation with a foreign partner about, for example, the domestic terrorism problem we were encountering in the United States and how there might be linkages to overseas individuals who might hold the same ideologies. And I also don't recall a single conversation with a state and local or tribal or territorial partner about that as well. And that's not something that feels very comfortable to say when you see the level of threat that has emerged in recent years. I know that my successors in the role, Admiral Joe McGuire and Russ Travers, who had the role as acting NCTC director for a period of time, went back to the drawing board to try and determine where NCTC could try to add value to a national effort on domestic terrorism issues. And he did that in close conversation with FBI leadership, because it was clear to all of us that FBI had the resident expertise. It certainly had the responsibility for leading the effort across the federal government to deal with domestic terrorism or domestic extremism, and of course DHS as well. So it was a case of NCTC having to look back at its authorities and say, wait a minute, this is a significant part of the terrorism problem, and we're not active in this space in supporting our partners. How do we do that? We're not trying to elbow our way in bureaucratically. That's not the point. The point is to figure out how do we find a way to bring a more whole of government perspective to this particular problem set. And I think that's an impulse that will be picked up upon by the new Biden administration. It wasn't lost on anybody on this call that last week, the White House spokesperson Jen Psaki highlighted what will be a forthcoming effort to have the White House, the National Security Council, lead an effort to get a grip on the set of domestic terrorism issues that we face. And they started with the idea of an intel assessment. They asked the DNI, Avril Haines, to lead an IC effort to examine the problem holistically and bring that forward to inform a policy process. David, before I stop, one last thing on the text that I want to circle back to. It's worth pointing out that this is an NTAS bulletin that never uses the word terrorism in it. It refers to the potential for acts of violence. At several points, it talks about how violent acts could be undertaken against critical infrastructure targets or particular political targets. It's just a signal to me that there's still a little bit of a need to dance around the topic of domestic extremist violence in terms of the way we talk about it. If we were talking about a homegrown violent extremist who was motivated by an ideology like that of ISIS or Al-Qaeda, we'd have no problem talking about their violent acts as being an act of terror. And yet that doesn't happen here.
Yeah, all of the terms and phrases that we've wrapped around that terrorism definition, of course, are here. The bulletin talks about violence and threats meant to intimidate or coerce based on politics. I mean, we're getting at what terrorism is about, but you're right. The word terrorism appears in the title of the product, but it doesn't appear in the actual subject.
And David,
yeah,
I just want to jump in because prior to Nick speaking just now, I had written down on my notes next to me, dance around. And I think that is a lot of what is going on. In addition to what Nick is pointing out, that the word terrorism does not appear in the text, the other piece that I think the public discussion of all of this going on is also dancing around is the fact that we have a increased domestic violent extremist or terrorism threat that is inspired by political actors in this country. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to talk about, you know, well, why is it that this particular bulletin didn't get issued until after January 20th, I'm pretty sure, and I'd be interested to hear what my colleagues think as well, that the reason is because two of the three topics that are covered, anger over COVID-19 restrictions and the 2020 election results, were specifically and directly instigated and inspired by the former president, his political allies, and the domestic political conversation. And until the country starts to deal with that, we're going to be continuing to dance around the fact that we now in 2021 are dealing with a potential domestic terrorism activity that is inspired by our domestic political actors, and the events of January 6th and the attack on the Capitol was a direct result of that.
Yeah. So first of all, I absolutely agree, Kerry, with your assessment of the nexus here to one obvious strong political motivator and inspiring political leader, that being our former president, and the current state of violence and unrest that we're seeing from these actors. But let me just for a second speak out about the value, or if not the value, the necessity of the dance around. And it gets to the fundamental difference between domestic terrorism and international terrorism. One of the reasons it's so much easier, if you're writing a bulletin about homegrown violent extremists who are motivated by or inspired by ISIS, you know, ISIS is a designated terrorist organization, and right, therefore we're able to investigate those people under the laws and the with the investigative techniques that we have that are available, and you know, to investigate international terrorists. Domestic terrorism is, you know, of course, we lack a statute that makes it a crime to simply be a domestic terrorist, right? Domestic terrorism is defined in the Federal Criminal Code, but there is no, essentially, there's no penalty for it. So we approach these cases from the perspective of you have to have a violent crime committed in pursuit of an ideology, a political ideology, racial ideology, an environmental ideology, it doesn't matter, but you have to start with the violent crime. So we hesitate to call domestic terrorists terrorists until after something has happened. Pretty easy to say what happened on January 6th in the Capitol was a clear act of domestic terrorism. You had numerous violent crimes committed by people who were consistently, you know, and uniformly motivated by the same political ideology, that being their support of President Trump and their belief in this lie that the election results had been somehow corrupted or stolen from them. But when you're looking prospectively, as the bulletin does, there are some legal potholes in terms of throwing that term out more broadly. So I'll stop there.
Well, I'm going to ask you to expand on that last point, because you're in a position to actually shed light on this, both at the tactical level. You worked on the Boston Marathon bombing, but as deputy director, you faced similar issues in different circumstances, true, but in similar ways. So how do you think the FBI is poised to navigate around those potholes, and is there a clear way forward?
I think there is. There's a couple of good issues that you raise there. First, I have to say, you know, reading some of this and listening to the national conversation about these issues has got to be very validating and satisfying on one level for the men and women, the agents and analysts in the FBI who've been working domestic terrorism issues for years. They have long suffered in the shadow of all things international terrorists. And so they're really having, unfortunately, their moment in the sun. I think one of the reasons that maybe Nick and I didn't have more conversations with each other or with our state and local partners about domestic terrorism back when we were in our respective positions is because the threat picture has changed so substantially. And without going into crazy detail, what the FBI saw on the domestic terrorist spectrum historically was numerous, very specific kind of issue or ideology focused groups. So you had your white supremacist groups, you had your sovereign citizens, you had your environmental extremists, you had, you know, folks who were really motivated by opposing federal government laws and practices with respect to land management, very kind of almost niche focused extremist activity. What's different now is all of those groups, well, most of them, have been united under a common cause. And that common cause is our former president. So your anti-government activists, you know, they despise this idea that the election was stolen from them. Your white supremacist activists and your anti-immigration extremists are drawn into that kind of pro-Trump political ideology because they believe, you know, they're supportive of building the wall in America first. So everybody's got their own reasons, but the president is the person and the, you know, really the political movement that has brought them all together, validated them by referring to these folks and their beliefs without condemning them. And so we have a really formidable force to reckon with now.
Absolutely. Elizabeth, I want to circle back to you. Earlier, you mentioned that even in a very dense document that packs in more words per page than almost anything I've seen, that there are many important things left unsaid in this bulletin. And I'd like you to expand on that.
Well, let me start with, this isn't a criticism. I think if I were in their shoes, I'd be doing the same thing. There was a product written before they got there. It was written with the assumption that it was going to be put out by the previous acting secretary, and somebody squashed it. I still haven't heard definitively who it was. So I'm sure they just dusted that off, updated. I thought Nick's point about the lack of the use of the word terrorism is interesting. I don't know whose influence that is, but I do think that given that Biden tasked the DNI to do an assessment, and notably he said to use not only internal government information, but also outside experts. And I think that has been missing, at least when I was serving. I was finding outside experts who they don't have some of the constraints that the government does in terms of First Sure. Amendment, Fourth Amendment activities. I found that experts outside of the government were much more insightful for that strategic picture of the nature of the threat. So it's good that they're going to bring those experts to the table and try to paint a picture of what this threat is and the various threat actors. And very critically, they need to have fact-based information to point to why certain threat actors are of more concern to the government, say white supremacist, violent extremists, and, you know, certain anti-government extremists that fall on the right side of the spectrum, like the militias, versus what President Trump has painted for the last year, this boogeyman of left-wing violent extremism and, you know, using the label Antifa, which is not a group. But if you talk to the average American, they think it is, and they think Antifa is going to ruin all of our cities. So there's a lot of disinformation out there. Maybe 40, 50% of the country has bought into the way that Trump was framing it. And in order to begin to try to correct some of that disinformation, they need to be very careful to stick to facts and do a rigorous analytic job, one that it would be difficult to do in, you know, being in office for a total of 4 days. I suspect that part of the reason they walk this fine line, they're also seeing the environment within, you know, I want to say it was within a few days, you had commentators on Fox News and Newsmax and OAN alleging that they is, you know, the deep state, they is, you know, the people on this podcast, anybody with counterterrorism experience, they is the progressive liberals, Nancy Pelosi, they're going to make all of us domestic terrorists. 74 million Americans that voted for Trump are going to be domestic terrorists. Just you wait. They're going to not let us practice our religion. They're going to shut down our churches. Like if you watch some of these, and some of these are happening on relatively mainstream, it's not just on Parler, for example, relatively mainstream conservative media, sadly, the disinformation has an effect, and it's going to make the job of counterterrorism officials harder, because what does that do? It feeds the anger, it feeds the grievance, and it has the effect of potentially taking people and radicalizing them further. It might justify in their minds why they do need to go join that militia, because their government has turned against them and the political process has failed them because the election was stolen. And therefore, it is appropriate for us to cry for revolution and fight back against the government. So I'd be interested in the other's thoughts on this. I mean, this is a very difficult space. Part of what brought us to the point that we are now is that the previous administration, with the exception of a few voices at the Department of Homeland Security and Director Wray, was not willing to talk about the threat from violent white supremacists and anti-government extremists. I mean, certainly never came out from the White House except for the comments about Antifa. So you have a lack of knowledge. And now you have this moment where people are scared that they're going to lose their freedoms, that they are being painted as a domestic terrorist. How do we talk about the threat in a way that does not ostracize half of the country?
And I do want, Nick, I want to turn to you in a moment, but on those lines, it is notable that in this bulletin, there is no mention of disinformation around the 2020 election itself and the events around January 6th at the Capitol. Instead, the only mention of misinformation and conspiracy theories are in the context of threats of violence against critical infrastructure, when it cites electric, telecom, and healthcare sectors being potential targets based on misinformation and conspiracy theories about COVID-19. They don't even address the political side, if you will, having to do with the election and the issues there. Nick, what's your response to Elizabeth on those points, both in the broad sense and then on the details that she mentioned?
Well, I did want to jump in after both Elizabeth and Andy made the point, because I think what's clearly happening here is we're seeing a massive increase in volume. That's what makes this the pressing public policy issue, the national security issue that it is for the Biden administration. As Andy reminded us, we've had no shortage in our past history of people you would label as domestic violent extremists or even domestic terrorists, if you had the statutory framework to call them that. What's different here is the volume coming about in large part for many of the reasons that Elizabeth articulated. The kind of the grievance narrative has crossed over so many different organizational or demographic lines to include more people. Now, and when you have more people buying into that grievance narrative, that just increases the pool of people who could potentially take the next step and the next step of going beyond grievance narrative to actually being radicalized. And then after being radicalized, to even going beyond that, to being willing and able to carry out acts of violence. And so this is a pathway that we understand well and have seen before. It plays out at various paces and in various ways. But this is something that's well understood, but we're at risk, I think, of being overwhelmed by volume. And then I guess the last thing I'd say, David, is that the next opportunity we'll have to, in a sense, hear from our government on this is not too far away, I would suspect. And that is when our intelligence community leaders gather, as they typically do in the February, March timeframe, for the all threats testimony that I know, Andy, you used to be a part of. I certainly used to be a part of. Avril Haines will certainly be bringing together heads of the intelligence community to present the full IC picture on threats to the United States, and where this set of issues features in that testimony, and what Director Wray has to say, what Secretary Mayorkas, assuming he's confirmed at that point, has to say, will be very telling, because they'll want to be pretty crisp and clear about the volume problem and the degree of resource requirement that they're going to face in getting a handle on this problem. So I think that would be an interesting indicator for us as to how they're thinking about this new problem after several weeks on the job.
There are so many issues in and around this, but we are running short on time. So I'm going to circle back through each of you to highlight anything else that's low-hanging fruit on this that we haven't mentioned or needs some additional explanation. Andy, you first. What else about this general topic strikes you, whether picking up on Nick's point or otherwise?
Well, I certainly concur with Nick's comments about the volume. I think the danger here is this is really budding across the country in all these different sectors as a political ideology. And as you know, all of us know from many years of doing this work, you can target individual actors, you can take people out off the deck for committing crimes and violating the law, but it is very, very hard to undermine or to eliminate an ideology, especially one that, as the Jib points out, is motivated by perceived grievances fueled by false narratives. I actually think that's a pretty bold statement for them to have included, because it's an obvious reference to the false statements that have motivated most of these folks involving the 2020 election. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it remains to be seen. The harder we lean forward into this problem, the greater chances, Elizabeth points out, that we motivate people to continue in that direction. But I just don't see any other way than addressing this head on.
Right. Carrie, final thoughts.
So I do think that our conversation is starting to preview what is going to be probably a significant policy and legislative debate over whether or not we should have a domestic terrorism law. And I'm already starting to hear murmurs about interest in this. And it's going to be very complicated. This is not straightforward, because one of the things that Elizabeth pointed out when she mentioned Antifa is that any consideration of trying to craft a law in this space is going to have to be thinking to the future and making sure that it's not a law that could be abused politically. Elizabeth's mention of Antifa is relevant because we might remember that it was just in September that the former Attorney General Bill Barr was making all sorts of public comments describing Antifa as a major instigator of violence across the country. And so one has to think through whether a potential law would be able to be used by a like-minded attorney general who might, you know, be in our future, that would be willing to designate groups or use investigative tools that are provided by new legislation in a way that really does politicize the intelligence and the investigation. So I think that's going to be a really hard and complex debate ahead.
Sure. Elizabeth, let's wrap this up. What has been uncovered here, or what deserves a final point of emphasis?
I agree with what Carrie just said. This is extremely complex, and I am not overly optimistic given the state of affairs in our politics, though somewhat comforted by the way in which the Biden administration has demonstrated how they plan to lead and some of the people that they brought in. It may merit a 9/11 commission style group coming together, maybe not meeting for as long as they did, but you almost need a bunch of experts not in the public eye able to hash out the pros and cons and come up with options that then can be debated publicly. I think it would be very difficult, and we've already seen this in the news cycle, various voices chiming in and almost making it impossible to have a reasonable conversation over what changes in the law should be. My personal opinion, just two little thoughts here. I think the conversation about domestic terrorism statutes and whether it helps or hurts tends to be, and rightly so, DOJ, FBI focused because it benefits them, you know, the most in terms of their investigative tools and ability to prosecute. But I think we need to look broader than just FBI and DHS, and changing the law may help, for example, DHS with some of its screening and vetting responsibilities. It may help for us to look at the intelligence community and what apparatuses they could bring to the fight. So I think we need to not just rely on the good work that's been done so far by some in the academic community, but truly bring together the operators and the various experts in the law to come up with what the option should be. And then the second thing would be that we need to encourage our public officials, especially those in Congress, to treat this seriously. I know that they're already planning on doing hearings. House Homeland has one next week. The Senate Judiciary is going to do one in the not too distant future on domestic terrorism. You know, voices like the folks on this podcast trying to bring to bear some calls or heeds for reasonable debate and not politicizing that. I think that's really important for the country to figure out the path forward. I'll just end with this. I don't have my own preformed conclusion on what the solution should be, but it does seem to me that we have not been able to carry out equal justice under the law for similar criminal activities. And Andy kind of referenced this, right? But if you look at it through the lens of a Black American or a Muslim American, it really does feel like the law treats certain types of terrorism differently than white terrorism. And if only for the sake of being able to, as a government, say that we are trying to pursue equal justice under the law, we should at least make the acts equivalent under the law, while still obviously needing to respect civil liberties and First and Fourth Amendment protections.
Thank you. And certainly, we all seem to agree that this bulletin is not the end, but the beginning of a larger conversation that we'll have going forward. Andy, Carrie, Nick, Elizabeth, thank you all for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Don't forget to share the podcast, rate the podcast, tweet about the podcast, post about the podcast on Facebook, as long as you don't mind being reviewed by the Facebook Oversight Board. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Zachary Frank is our audio engineer. Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.